Hey, welcome to a brand new episode of Andre Knows Everything. I'm Andre, and today I wanted to talk to you guys about a bunch of different things. I want to remind you that this is the show where I take you through the internet one topic at a time. We're going to learn about it together. I don't know anything about anything yet, but by the end of the episode, we'll both be smarter. But first, before I get into our main topic of the show, I kind of wanted to talk about my face. If you can see, I look a little bit different than I did earlier, and that is because in the last episode, and that is because I had a tragic accident just the other night, where I was sent to the hospital after getting knocked the fuck out, and as cool as this brand new scar on my face looks, if you're an audio listener, please tune in to the YouTube version of the show. As cool as it looks, the story is far less cool, far less. So, not last night, the night before last night, I woke up in the middle of the night to go pee-pee, you know, as one is wont to do. I got up, I went to the bathroom, walked in, did my business, and then on my way out, I must have, and I say must have because I don't actually remember it happening, I must have slammed my face into something as I was walking back to my bed, and I knocked myself out, scratched up my eye, laid on the floor, and was unconscious. And then I woke up sometime later, I have no idea how long I was out, and realized my face was bleeding, woke up my wife, we contacted the paramedics, they came to check me out to make sure I was not concussed and whatnot, and then we drove to the hospital where they did a CT scan and they applied some adhesive to the big scar that's happening right here above my eyebrow, and I was discharged and sent on my merry way. And it's really just a testament to the title of the podcast, you know. I do know everything, you know. And by that I mean I'm probably one of the dumbest people on earth, and I somehow managed to knock myself out in the middle of the night. And the funniest thing about it is my wife, when I came to, or when I woke her up, I said, babe, I was still very out of it at this point. I was very dizzy. I said, babe, I hit my head. I'm hurt. And she said, what happened? Did you hit your head on your iPad? Now it was dark. It was dark that night. She couldn't see me. She couldn't see the amount of blood that was on my face quite yet. But for her to think that I would wake her up because I bumped my head against my iPad was just really insulting to me. Anyway, all that to say, that I look different now. I am probably permanently scarred forever because I ran into a wall, after I went pee-pee. And that was it. This looks like a straight up fight scar. Like, I look like I pulled out a sword and battled somebody on a rooftop or something like that. And I came away with this scar and the other guy's dead, but that's not what happened at all. I ran into some furniture and I went night-night, basically. That's what happened. So don't do drugs, kids. Anyway, let's move on to the main topic of this episode. I wanted to talk to you about voting. It is an election year, the year of our Lord 2020, and the way that we are going to vote in this particular election during this particular pandemic is going to be slightly different than it has been in past years. So I kind of wanted to go through the history of voting, the history of people getting the right to vote. It didn't happen to all of us all at the same time. I wasn't there, but you know, it affected me all the same. Then we'll look a little bit through like the Electoral College, how all that stuff works, and we'll finally stop on some mail-in voting and see exactly what it's going to take for us to get our ballots in this November. So this is going to be an educational episode for everybody, I hope, especially me, because I don't really know about any of this. I have voted in every election that has come about since I was 18, I believe. Turned 18 in 2009, so I missed the 2008 election by like 4 months. Like, it was November, and then I turned 18 in February of that next year. So I missed that, and that was something that everybody in my high school was like really hyped up about. It got us excited to go out and vote, even though a lot of us weren't able to vote at that time. But ever since then, I have found it to be my civic duty to go out and vote in elections and make change or whatever. And this year, more than ever, I feel like I should kind of be up on my stuff and know exactly how I'm going to get my vote in and how to do it correctly. So let's go through the history of voting, and we'll circle on back to how to get our mail-in ballots counted. All right. So I pulled up this graphic from the Secretary of State of Washington's government, sos.wa.gov. I pulled up this this graphic from the Secretary of State of Washington website, sos.wa.gov. It's just a history of voting in America. We can see some lovely old-timey images here. So let's just go through this real quick. This will be our kind of baseline for everything that we're going to look up a little bit later. So in 1776, voting was controlled by individual state legislatures, okay? Only white men aged 21 and older who owned land could vote. Okay, that was 1776, the founding of our country. Everybody who voted for George Washington was a white man over the age of 21 who also happened to own land. Not me and not any women who listen to the show. That's it. A little bit later in... almost 100 years later, in 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution grants full citizenship rights, including voting rights, to all men born or naturalized in the United States. Now, it fails to mention in this particular graphic that this was basically for black men and other men of color. Like, it says that all men, as opposed to just white men, but... 1868 is right after the Civil War ended, and slaves had become free by this point. So anyone who was not white was given the right to vote. Now, that right to vote was messed with after that, and I don't think that this necessarily mentions that at all anywhere in here. But let's keep going before I get into two-thirds stuff. In 1870, the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution eliminates racial barriers to voting. However, many states continue practicing voter discrimination. Poll taxes, literacy tests, which I'm failing right now, fraud, and intimidation still prevent many from voting. Native Americans are still denied the right to vote. Okay, so they did pull it in. Look at that. That was in 1870. If we scroll down here to 1910... it says Washington voters amend the state constitution allowing women to vote and run for office. That was in 1910. Okay. And in 1912, Washington voters amend the state constitution giving citizens the power to propose initiatives and referenda. The first statewide initiative in 1914 bans alcohol sales. So we're having some prohibition at the same time as some suffrage. Okay, and then in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified, giving women the right to vote nationwide. All right, now we're all on an equal playing field. It only took from 1776 to 1920. Kind of a long amount of time. In 1923, Washington State voters passed Initiative 40, repealing the poll tax. Poll taxes are used in many states as a way to discriminate against certain voters. So you have to, like, pay to vote, which you shouldn't have to do. It's free. In 1924, the Indian Citizenship Act grants Native Americans citizenship and voting rights. So I thought we were on an equal playing field in 1920. I guess not. It took until 1924 for the first people who were here to be able to vote here. 1776 to 1924. It's a long span of time in there. Anyway, anywho. Scroll down here a little bit. This is all very Washington focused because it's on Washington's government website, but I think it still mostly applies to the rest of the U.S. In 1964, the Federal Civil Rights Act is passed to ensure that all men and women age 21 and older, regardless of race, religion, or education, have the right to vote. The 24th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified, eliminating poll taxes nationwide. So none of y'all can get away with putting a tax on going to the polls as of 1964. In 1965, the Federal Voting Rights Act suspends literacy tests. Registration and voting rights are now federally enforced. So the way that it's looking to me is that a lot of this takes a lot of time to build up, whereas, you know, in our history books, it seems like the Founding Fathers, you know, they started writing their little constitution and their Declaration of Independence or whatever, and they're like, hey, everybody's created equal, we all in here together, we all gonna do this right from the jump. And that just isn't true even a little bit at all. Like, not even close. It took 200 years for them to get it even close to being fair for everybody. And even now, it's still not necessarily completely fair. In 1971, the 26th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution lowers the voting age to 18. I didn't realize that. That's something I did not know. I thought that it had been 18 at the start, but it was saying 21 almost this entire time, which probably is where the drinking age being at 21 comes from. You were just a more adulty adult at 21 than 18 in the past. In 1975, the Federal Voting Rights Act is renewed, permanently banning literacy tests nationwide. Section 203 is added, requiring translated voting materials in areas with large numbers of citizens with limited English skills. So here in California, there is absolutely a Spanish version of your ballot and any voting materials handed out when you get it. And I assume that in other states there might be some other languages, maybe French somewhere in there, maybe German or something like that, but probably Spanish and just a lot of other states as they are our closest different language, right? Not closest in language speak, but closest geographically. Anyway, in 1984, the Federal Voting Accessibility for the Elderly and Handicapped Act requires polling places to be accessible to people with disabilities. So now we're just getting more and more progressive as time goes on. Let's be more inclusive to let everybody vote so that as many votes as possible can be counted. In fact, I think after I finish with this, I'll look up and see like some voting stats to see exactly how many people in the U.S. regularly vote, because there's 330 million people in the U.S. and nowhere close to that number is actually voting, right? Okay. Jumping up to 2000. In the year 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court decides the presidential election after dubious ballot counting practices call into question Florida's electoral votes. The incident sparks a national outcry and a wave of election reforms. The U.S. Census reveals that Washington's non-English-speaking population has grown large enough that some counties must translate voting materials in compliance with the 1975 Voting Rights Act. Okay. In 2008, after a lengthy U.S. Supreme Court battle, Washington enacts the top two primary that allows voters to choose any candidate regardless of party preference. Right, because you have to list your party preference on your ballot, and that determines who you're allowed to vote for, which I've always thought is a little bit odd. And I guess that's just for, like, it's like census data. We want to know who's in what party and who's voting for who within those parties. But it kind of is weird to me that you're not allowed to vote for anybody else once you've marked yourself as Democratic or Independent or Republican or whatever on your ballot. Okay. In 2009, Washington becomes the second state in the U.S. after Oregon to vote entirely by mail rather than in person at the polls. And today, about, I don't know when this was written, today, about 4 million people are registered to vote in Washington, roughly 68% of those eligible. 68%. So, let me check out some voting averages. My caps lock is on at the moment. Voter turnout demographics from the electproject.org. Okay, this goes by year starting in the 80s. We're looking at turnouts of by race, turnouts by age. Oh, okay, that's kind of it. I kind of just wanted like a voter turnout data. All right. Okay. Let's go through the 2016 general election. In California, 58% of all VEP total balance counted. I don't know what any of these mean. Voting eligible population. Okay, so in California, specifically, only 58% of voting eligible population turned in a ballot, or had their ballot counted. 58%. So just under 60% of the population is voting. And it looks like in most states, it's around there. It's around 60, 70%. Let's see who's got the big numbers. Minnesota, 74% of the voting population turned in ballots. Yeah, that's it. Everybody else is at 60. Who's on the low end of this spectrum? Arkansas only has 53%. Their ballots counted. Okay. And then Tennessee only has 51%. Texas only has 51% turning in ballots. So overall, I'd assume that that average is around 60%. 60% of people vote in every general election. That's called quick math, baby. Quick math. Okay, so let's go to elections in the United States. Let's find out a little bit more about how this stuff actually works. Okay, there are different voting systems in each state. It looks like most states use a very similar system, if I can tell by this, this very red map. It says on Wikipedia, the most common method used in U.S. elections is the first-past-the-post system, where the highest polling candidate wins the election. Excuse me. Under this system, a candidate only requires a plurality of votes to win, rather than an outright majority. Some may use a two-round system, where if no candidate receives a required number of votes, then there is a runoff between the two candidates with the most votes. A candidate only requires a plurality of votes to win, rather than an outright majority. Okay. Since 2002, several cities have adopted instant runoff voting in their elections. Voters rank the candidates in order of preference rather than voting for a single candidate. If a candidate secures more than half of votes cast, that candidate wins. Otherwise, the candidate with the fewest votes is eliminated. Ballots assigned to the eliminated candidate are recounted and assigned to those of the remaining candidates who rank next in order of preference on each ballot. This process continues until one candidate wins by obtaining more than half the votes. In 2016, Maine became the first state to adopt instant runoff voting, known in the state as ranked choice voting, which sounds better, in my opinion, statewide for its elections. Although due to state constitutional provisions, the system is only used for federal and soon presidential elections and presidential and state primaries. Okay, did that make sense to you? Because it made sense, but it read a little highfalutin, in my opinion. Okay, this is not the dumbed down version of this. I'm looking at this map. Okay, so most states are doing first past the post system. There's like two states that are doing a two-round system. I think it looks like only Maine is doing that instant runoff voting. Louisiana has a Louisiana primary, whatever that means. And then California and, is that Washington? Yes. Are both doing a nonpartisan blanket primary. Let's pretend that we know what all that stuff means, okay? We're going to keep going. Eligibility, okay? The eligibility of an individual for voting is set out in the Constitution and also regulated at state level. The Constitution states that suffrage cannot be denied on grounds of race or color, sex or age for citizens 18 years or older. Beyond these basic qualifications, it is the responsibility of state legislatures to regulate voter eligibility. Some states ban convicted criminals, especially felons, from voting for a fixed period of time or indefinitely. I believe that's the situation in California. In my mind, if I'm going to jail, I don't get to vote anymore, basically. Which, in my opinion, is a little messed up. Like, I understand that maybe while I'm in jail, I can't vote, right? That could be a punishment for my the crime that I committed or whatever. But it seems like after I have served my time, that hurts my face. After I've served my time and I'm back in society as a citizen, I should still be able to voice my opinion on the country that I live in by voting. But somebody determined that that's not worth it. Anywho, the number of American adults who are currently or permanently ineligible to vote due to felony convictions is estimated to be 5.3 million. Holy moly, that's a lot of people. Some states also have legacy constitutional statements barring legally declared incompetent from voting. Such references are generally considered obsolete and are being considered for review or removal where they appear. Legally declared incompetent from voting. Legally declared. So I assume this is people with like mental disabilities or something like that. You've been legally declared incompetent from voting. In what other situation would you be legally declared incompetent from voting? Because there's a couple people I can think of off the top of my head that should be legally declared incompetent. But, you know, that's not my that's not my place to deem them as so. 5.3 million people are currently or permanently ineligible to vote due to felony convictions. That's a lot. That's a large percentage of the population that just can't cast a vote at all. That's interesting. And I wonder if that were to ever get overturned, that like if you're a felon, you can't vote. If that were to be overturned now, right, saying everybody who's a felon can suddenly vote, those 5.3 million people, could that turn the tide of an election? Sounds like it. Seems like a couple million people absolutely could. Okay. Voter registration. Okay, so I just checked to see if I'm registered to vote in California. I am. Check that out. But while I was checking, I realized that they were not going to send me my ballot in the mail. So I'm really glad that I'm doing this episode today because I almost missed it. I was going to have to go to a polling place, and I don't think many of those are going to be open in my county where I live here. So I might have to travel particularly far or whatever due to COVID. Anyway, so check to see if you're registered to vote. I think I have a website pulled up here. Okay. Yes, for me. All right. I got it. For me, it was voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. This is the Secretary of State's website, and you can check to see if you're registered to vote and update your registration if you are not. So check that out. Do that. Get registered. Let's rock the vote this November. Okay, you know, it's like let's rock it out. All right, rock that vote. Anywho, let's keep going. Voter registration. Okay, while the federal government has jurisdiction over federal elections, most election laws are decided at the state level. all U.S. states except North Dakota require that citizens who wish to vote be registered. Traditionally, voters had to register at state offices to vote, but in the mid-1990s, efforts were made by the federal government to make registering easier in an attempt to increase turnout. The National Voter Registration Act of 1993, or the Motor Voter Law, required state governments that received certain types of federal funding to make the voter registration process easier by providing uniform registration services through driver's license registration centers, disability centers, schools, libraries, and mail-in registration. Other states allow citizens same-day registration on election day. So you could be like, I don't care, I'm not registered, la-di-da-di-da, and then it's election day, and you're like, oh, I guess I want to vote. Then you can register and then cast your vote all in the same time and then dip up out of there. In many states, citizens registering to vote may declare an affiliation with a political party. This declaration of affiliation does not cost money and does not make the citizen a dues-paying member of the party. A party cannot prevent a voter from declaring his or her affiliation with them, but it can refuse requests for full membership. In some states, only voters affiliated with a party may vote in that party's primary elections. Declaring a party affiliation is never required. Some states, including Georgia, Michigan, Minnesota, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Washington, practice nonpartisan registration. So that's interesting. You don't have to be a full member of the party where you're paying dues and whatnot, which is not something that I'm ever going to do. Never, ever, 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 ever. Okay. So that's registering. And then absentee and mail-in voting. I think I have an entire Wikipedia article about this pulled up already. Elections. Voting rights. But let's read this anyway, okay? Absentee and mail-in voting. Voters unable or unwilling to vote at polling stations on election day may vote via absentee ballots. Isn't that nice? Depending on state law. Originally, these ballots were for people who could not go to polling places on election day. Now, some states let them be used for convenience, but state laws still call them absentee ballots. Absentee ballots can be sent and returned by mail or requested and submitted in person or dropped off in locked boxes. I've done this several times when I voted. I get my ballot in the mail. I fill that sucker out, and then instead of mailing it back, I just go to a polling place and drop that sucker off, and then they count my votes. And that seems, the only reason I do that instead of mailing it back is just so that I know that someone got it. You know, it's weird. I really am not a big fan of the mail system. I feel like I've lost stuff in the mail several times. So I just don't trust it that much, and especially this year, I'm hoping that there will be a polling place around where I can drop off my ballot, but I'll probably end up mailing it in, because ain't nothing open right now. Nothing. Okay. About half the states and territories allow no-excuse absentee, where no reason is required to request an absentee ballot. Others require a valid reason, such as infirmity or travel. Some states let voters with permanent disabilities apply for permanent absentee voter status, and some other states let all citizens apply for permanent status, so they will automatically receive an absentee ballot for each election. Otherwise, a voter must request an absentee ballot before the election occurs. So that was the situation I found myself in today. I checked to see if my ballot was going to be mailed to me. It said no. No, you can just go to a polling place just like any other normal non-pandemic year. And so I had to change that setting. So you might be registered to vote, but you still might not be receiving a ballot in the mail if you're living in California like I am. So check that stuff out. Get registered right and get your ballot in the mail so you can send it in. And we can have a new president. Okay. And in these other states, all ballots are delivered through the mail. In many other states, there are counties or certain small elections where everyone votes by mail. Americans living outside the United States may register and vote under the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, or OCAVA. Almost half the states require these ballots to be returned by mail. Other states allow mail along with some combination of fax or email. Excuse me. Four states allow a web portal. So that's kind of the thing that I would like to push for is as convenient as mail-in voting is, it would be so much more convenient if we could all just vote online, right? You vote for shit online all the time, constantly. I feel like I'm taking a survey every other day. There's polls. There's you used to be able to text in to American Idol to vote and shit like that. I mean, it's just so easy to see those numbers. But I think the problem with voting specifically is voting online is that it's like what easily hackable, I guess. That somebody could get in there and fudge those numbers pretty easily, either at a small or a very, very large scale, right? Like somebody could go in and make it so that everyone in California voted for Donald Trump this year or whatever, you know, or make it so that like 16% of each county is going to be voting for the opposite party of who they voted for. And that would fudge the numbers enough that it could turn the tide of an entire election, right? And that's just hard to bypass, I guess, and without some serious thought being put into it. And I don't know that any thought is being put into it at this point, although it definitely should be, right? Somebody should be developing this system where every American can just hop on their phone, send in their vote, and be done with it. But I don't know that that's actually happening. But we'll see in the coming years. I expect that mail-in voting and in-person voting are not going to be the only ways to vote within the next like 50 years. I think at some point we'll get a way to vote online or vote by text or vote by phone or something like that, you know, something that's a little bit more convenient instead of because as we'll see a little bit later, maybe I'll jump to it right now. There's been a lot of controversy around certain elections and certain voting practices, and there's voter fraud, and there's all kinds of stuff like that can go wrong during an election, okay? All right, so I think we've covered the basics. Yes, there are different types of elections. There are different people that you vote for. There's local elections. There's primaries. There's general elections. I'm mostly focusing on, like, the presidential elections, but you should be paying attention to what's going on in your local town or municipality while this is happening as well. Oh, okay. So before we jump into voter fraud and all that stuff, let's just talk about the Electoral College just a little bit, because this is something that still kind of befuddles me and something that I am not a super big fan of, the Electoral College, but I guess I kind of understand. Let's just read about it and figure out what it is, okay? The Electoral College is a body of electors established in the United States Constitution, which forms every 4 years for the sole purpose of electing the President and Vice President of the United States. The Electoral College consists of 538 electors, and an absolute majority of at least 270 electoral votes is required to win the election, okay? So we got 500 peeps. 500, and these are all delegates, right? They're all senators and governors, I believe. And you need, as a presidential candidate, you need 270 of these votes to win. So these people got to vote for one or the other, and they're supposed to vote based on the population of their delegacy of where they govern. All right. Here is a handy dandy little map about where each of the Electoral College's delegates are allocated. Electoral votes allocated to each state and to the District of Columbia for the 2012, 2016, and 2020 primary presidential elections based on populations from the 2010 census. So you see that each state gets a certain number of electoral votes, right? California is a huge state, so it gets 55. Texas is a huge state, so it gets 38. But what is this? Nevada only has 6. Alaska only has 3. So on election night, if you're watching the news, you'll see them talking about, okay, well, Ohio's coming in and it's going over to Bush or whatever. And that's because those votes in that state have to be counted. Then the electorals can go in and vote their way, right? Let's keep reading because I feel like I'm talking nonsense now. According to Article 2 of the Constitution, each state legislature determines the manner by which its state's electors are chosen. The number of each state's electors is equal to the sum of the state's membership in the Senate and House of Representatives. Currently, there are 100 senators and 435 representatives. Additionally, the 23rd Amendment, ratified in 1961, provides that the district established pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, as the seat of the federal government, is entitled to the number it would have if it were a state, but in no case more than that of the least populous state. U.S. territories are not entitled to any electors. Okay. Following the nationwide presidential election day, on the Tuesday after the first Monday of November, each state counts its popular votes according to that state's laws to designate presidential electors. In 48 states and D.C., the winner of the plurality of the statewide vote receives all of that state's electors. In Maine and Nebraska, two electors are assigned in this manner, and the remaining electors are allocated based on the plurality of votes in each congressional district. Okay, so the numbers are coming in, right? The votes are coming in. Let's say we got Trump over here and Biden over here, right? If the state has more Biden votes than Trump votes, then all of the electors for that state will go to Biden, right? And if, let's say Texas is voting, right? And more people in Texas are voting for Trump than they are voting for Biden. That means all 38 electoral votes will go to Trump for that state, even if it's like 49% and 50%, you know, or 51%, however math works, right? So that 51% means that Trump gets all of those votes for Texas, getting him ever closer to that 270 electoral votes that he needs to win, okay? And so in elections past, I believe in the 2016 election even, you can win the presidential election by electoral votes, but still have still not be winning the popular vote, right? So more people could be voting for your candidate, but the other candidate can win if they get more electoral votes. And that's the part that I don't like. if I'm going in and voting for this person, and me and everybody I know are voting for this person, but our state still ends up giving that vote to the other person, that makes me a little mad. Scarface mad. Okay. I feel like I'm rambling on at this point. And I definitely don't want to read all of this. So, let's jump over into some fun stuff. All right, I have here a list of controversial elections in the United States. These are kind of just tidbits. I'll read through a couple of them, and then I'll dive deep on one in particular. Okay, in 1792, the New York gubernatorial election, the Federalist Party candidate John Jay received more votes than the Democratic Republican Party candidate George Clinton. But on technicalities, the votes of Otsego, Tioga, and Clinton counties were disqualified and not canvassed, giving George Clinton a slight majority in the official result. Okay. I didn't understand a lot of what that means. I'm going to read only the ones that say presidential election. Okay. In 1824, the presidential election, John Quincy Adams became president after winning a contingent election in the House of Representatives due to the absence of a two-thirds majority in the Electoral College, despite the fact that Andrew Jackson, who would win in the 1828 presidential election 4 years later, won a plurality of the vote and electoral vote. So John Quincy Adams won and became president due to the absence of a two-thirds majority in the Electoral College, despite the fact that Andrew Jackson won a plurality of the vote and electoral vote. So how did he win? I don't even understand. All right, let's keep going because I ain't got time to be looking all these up. All right. in the 1888 United States presidential election, the incumbent Democrat president Grover Cleveland won a majority of the popular vote, but Benjamin Harrison won the electoral vote. Cleveland would later be reelected in the 1892 presidential reelection. Okay. All right, let's jump to the one that I actually care about because I was alive for. All right. In 2000, the United States presidential election. After a close election in which the winner was unclear, the Republican candidate George W. Bush won Florida by such a slim margin that a recount of the votes was triggered under Florida state law, beginning a series of legal battles between the Bush and the Democratic candidate Al Gore and considerable public controversy. After the completion of a machine recount, the Florida Supreme Court ordered a manual recount due to continued concerns over the validity of the election. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court, which halted the recount in the Bush v. Gore and Bush v. Palm Beach County Canvassing Board decisions, allowing Bush to capture the state of Florida by a, oh my God, a 0.0009% margin and win the electoral vote. It was so close. So I was only 9 years old when this happened, all right? But I remember it being contentious everywhere in the country. People were so mad at Florida that they allowed Bush to win this election. It was crazy. So I believe I have an article pulled up here. This is an article from NPR in November of 2018. It says, the Florida recount of 2000, a nightmare that goes on haunting. So I just want to read just a little bit of this just to get some context. All right. Florida 2000. That phrase is being invoked a lot in light of this year's ultra-tight Florida statewide elections. While the stakes might not be quite as high this time, they are nonetheless substantial. The governorship of Florida, a seat in the U.S. Senate, and the Office of State Agricultural Commission, there's a load of high-profile, high-value races. But in 2000, the prize was presidency of the United States. As the Electoral College vote took shape on election night, with the results piling up from around the country, it was clear the vote in Florida was going to determine not only the winner of that state's 25 electoral votes, but the next occupant of the Oval Office. It was these 25 electoral votes that were going to decide who was going to be president, Bush or Gore. Okay? Although Gore had won the popular vote by roughly 500,000 ballots, the all-important Electoral College count from the other 49 states and District of Columbia, was so close that whoever won Florida would be the overall winner. So that's just the way that this game happens to work tonight. All right. The margin in the Sunshine State was so close that it took one's breath away. While the races in Florida last week appeared to be decided by thousands or tens of thousands, the presidential count there in 2000 was being measured in hundreds. Ultimately, it came down to just 537 votes out of 6 million cast. So 6 million people voted in Florida, and only 537 was the margin between Bush and Gore, which is pretty crazy. When we revisit the gut-wrenching night of November 7th, 2000, we recall that the TV networks looked at exit polls and sample swing precincts from Florida and declared it a win for Al Gore, who was the incumbent vice president and the Democratic nominee for president. Okay, so they were calling it for Al. Al won it. Okay, among those making that call were ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and the AP. Their predictions came not long after the official closing time for voting in the state, when relatively few votes had actually been counted. By 8 p.m. Eastern, on their election night specials, the national networks were calling populous swing states such as Pennsylvania and Michigan for Gore. Taken together with Florida, those states triggered the network's computer programs to conclude Gore would win the Electoral College. Viewers around the country would soon see Gore's face on screen as a projected winner of the presidency. Celebrations began in Democratic headquarters everywhere. Yay, Al! He invented the internet! He's gonna be the president! Hooray! After calling the race, the networks began getting phone calls from Republicans. One of them from the campaign of Republican nominee George W. Bush, then governor of Texas. Bush's chief strategist Karl Rove phoned Fox News to insist that Florida was still in play. He shared his displeasure with someone who was likely to offer a sympathetic ear, John Ellis, a Fox analyst and member of the extended Bush family. Soon, the on-air personalities on Fox were telling viewers to reserve judgment on Florida. Before long, other networks were hearing the objections and reaching the same conclusion. So, basically, through that night and the next day, and I think several days after that, it was just a fight. It was like George Bush won, Gore won, Bush won, Gore won, Bush, Gore, recount, 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 count, count again. And then, I believe they took it to court. Okay. The Republicans appealed that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, which voted 7-2 to end the Florida court's ordered recount. In a 5-4 vote, the justices also ruled that no alternative method of recount could be established in a timely manner. In effect, the latter ruling made Bush president. That 5-4 majority was composed of the nominees of Republican presidents George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Richard Nixon. The four in the minority had been nominated by three presidents, Republicans Gerald R. Ford and George H.W. Bush, and Democrat Bill Clinton. Bush v. Gore has been regarded as one of the most politically consequential decisions in the history of the court, and one that damaged the court's preferred image of itself as an institution far removed from everyday partisan politics. Right. That's why nowadays, whenever a president picks a Supreme Court justice, everybody's like on edge. That's why old homeboy, Mr. Rapity Rape, what's his name? Kavanaugh? Brett Kavanaugh, yes. When he got nominated to Supreme Court Justice last year, the year before last, whenever it was, everybody was in a tizzy about it. And they took him to Congress and had him testify and had the lady come in and she was crying. And it was a whole shebang. Because these people can determine some of the biggest things, biggest law changes that happened in our country. And so the individual... Yeah, there's only 9 of these motherfuckers, okay? And the individual's politics can end up turning the tide of the entire country. So they're under a lot of scrutiny. Sorry for calling him Mr. Rapey Rape. No, I'm not. He's rapey. Okay. So that's Florida for you. You know, it's a mess. and there those decisions ended up giving Bush the election, and we all know he caused 9/11. All right, that's a joke. That's a joke. Okay, so let's move on here. The last thing. Okay, so we're gonna go back to mail-in voting. Just so that we all know what the deal is here in 2020 for our election in November, right? It's pandemic time. So polling places are not going to be open. So mail-in voting is kind of essential. But our president, Donald Trump, keeps saying, he just keeps on hammering on that mail-in voting causes a lot of fraud. You can vote twice. You can vote 3 or 4 times. You can. It's gonna be a wash. And he's also said that should he happen to lose this election, he's not gonna accept the results until every ballot has been counted or whatever the fuck it is he's saying. Okay, so let's understand what it is about mail-in voting that might cause some fraud, and how to do it correctly so that there isn't any fraud. Maybe my dog will calm down about it. Okay, while President Trump has questioned the reliability of mail-in voting, experts say it's safe and secure. But this year, counting the votes is most likely going to take longer than usual because many states will allow extra time for ballots to arrive after Election Day as long as they're postmarked on or before November 3rd. Okay, CNN has surveyed all of the state election offices. Here's what you need to know. Click on your state for more guidance. Okay, so it looks like most states, all voters can request a mail-in ballot. In several states, primarily vote by mail in the election. And then in a few states, an excuse is required to vote by mail. So those include Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Indiana. Okay, they say only eligible voters can request one with an acceptable excuse. The last day to request one is October 22nd. And it just needs to arrive on or before Election Day, November 3rd. And in-person early voting offers early or absentee in-person voting for everyone beginning October 6th. Okay.
That's interesting. Wait. What's happening? What's going on this website? Oh, I thought this was a full article, but it's just like this. Okay, let's read these little facts. 9 states, plus the District of Columbia, will conduct their elections primarily by mail by automatically sending ballots to registered voters. Another 35 states will allow any voter to request a ballot to vote by mail. Voters need to provide an acceptable excuse to vote by mail in the remaining 6 states, shown here in red, the ones I just mentioned. Voters casting their ballots by mail will need to send them early enough to arrive in time to be counted. The 28 yellow states, if you're looking at the video, I have the map of the weird U.S. here. The 28 yellow states will only count ballots that arrive before or on November 3rd. The remaining 22 green states plus the District of Columbia will count all ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day, even if they arrive later. Those deadlines vary by state. So what that means is that votes are going to be coming in the night of, the day of Election Day, and then after that day, right? So depending on where the voting is coming from, it's very possible that one of the candidates will be like, bam, I won, son. And then 2 days later, the rest of the votes will be counted and be like, remember when I said I won? I apparently did not, because of the way that these votes and ballots are going to be counted. That's kind of fascinating to me. The green states that will accept ballots after Election Day represent 313 of the nation's 538 Electoral College votes, or 58%. Okay, that's one reason a winner might not be declared right away on election night. And since Trumpy keeps saying that he's not going to accept losing, I guess, he's not going to accept the failure of him not winning on election night. I mean, he might be right in that effect, where if he loses on election night, by a day or two later, he might have won, depending on how the nation will be voting this November. the map has changed. Okay, hang on. When does my ballot need to arrive? Okay, many of those green states allow a grace period of about a week for postmarked ballots to arrive in case of postal service delays. That's another issue that's happening now in the country. Washington state allows the longest grace period. Any ballots that arrive by November 23rd, nearly 3 weeks after Election Day, will still be counted in Washington state as long as they are postmarked by November 3rd. So if the delays are 3 weeks long, those ballots are still going to be counted, and the Electoral College will have to vote in that direction. That's kind of crazy. So we as a country might not know who the real president is until like December. And most of the time we know on election night. That's pretty nuts. For voters who are unable to vote by mail or would rather vote in person, all but 5 states offer some form of early in-person voting to all voters. An excuse is necessary to vote early in person in Mississippi, Missouri, and South Carolina. New Jersey and Oregon allow limited early in-person voting because their elections will be conducted entirely by mail. So no polling places will be open in New Jersey or Oregon. Okay, so very, very interesting. Very interesting. if you're interested in politics at all, I try not to throw a ton of my personal opinions in here, but here's a few. I will be voting for Joe Biden this coming election. You don't have to. I'm just telling you who I'm voting for. I'm going to do that by mail. They're going to send me my ballot. I'm going to fill it out as soon as it comes in, and I'm going to send it out that very same day to ensure that my vote is counted on time, even though I believe my state is one that will have a grace period. In California it says your ballot needs to be postmarked on or before November 3rd, and it needs to arrive by November 20th. So, and I believe I should be receiving my ballot by sometime in early October, like October 6th or 8th or something like that. So on that day, I'll get my ballot, I'm going to vote, I'm going to send it in, so that I can get that orange piece of shit out of the White House. I truly hate Donald Trump the most, and I want him out of the White House, and I think he should have been out long before now. But That being said, I am fully prepared for another 4 years of this asshole governing us, and hopefully it doesn't take that long for him to get out of there. But it's very, very, very possible. He has a lot of fans, and they will be voting as well. So depending on which way you lean politically, go out there, make sure you're registered to vote, cast your ballot when it comes in the mail. And hopefully the mail, get it in as soon as possible, because the mail will be experiencing some delays this November, for sure. As soon as those ballots are starting to go out, the mail is going to get hit hard. And you want to get yours in as early as possible so that it's counted correctly. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, that's been it for this week, you guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Andre Knows Everything. I hope you learned something. I know I did, for sure. Small PSA, you know, turn the lights on when you're going to the bathroom at night. You know, make sure that you know where your walls are. Check them out. Make sure you're not running into shit. Okay, and then also make sure you're registered to vote. Go to that voter status website, voterstatus.sos.ca.gov if you're in California, or, you know, a different website if you live in a different state. If you live outside of the U.S. and are listening to this, thank you, first of all. But also, pray for us, dog. We are going through it right now, as I'm sure are you. Okay, you guys, that's been it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can keep up with me. I'm at Andre Morton Jr. on social media. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I think I have a Facebook page up as well. I'm on TikTok at Andre Knows Everything. You can watch my TikTokies. And subscribe to the show. Click the subscribe button, hit the like button, hit the notification bell if you're on YouTube. Leave a comment down below. Let me know if you're registered to vote or if this inspired you to register to vote. And if you're not voting, let me know why. Put it in the comments below. Tell me your policies, your personal policies. Let me check those out. I want to know. That's it. Hit subscribe. If you're an audio listener, check out the video show. Subscribe. I'm available on all the podcast platforms. Get me there. Listen to my other podcast, The Walt Vault. We talk about less political things all the time. So check those out there. All right, you guys. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Andre Morton, and I now know more today than I did yesterday. Bye.